Hey everyone, it's Hans. Just wanted to give you a quick heads up here that the audio for this episode, my audio is kind of terrible. I'm not really sure why. I don't think it's unlistenable, but it's a little bit muffled and touch echoey and just kind of sounds lousy. I've fixed it, not an issue in the future. I do think this is a really interesting discussion of Bleak House, a pretty widely beloved classic novel that we turned out not to like very much. But, you know, I hope everybody sticks with it in spite of the audio quality and won't be an issue in the future. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Book Spider, a Book of the Week format podcast which discusses the interplay between technology, literature, and history. Or at least that's what we're trying for today with a discussion of Charles Dickens's Bleak House, with the perhaps tenuous goal of making Bleak House emblematic of the whole wobbling edifice of the Anglo-American literary tradition. So, normally at this point we would summarize the plot of whatever book we are discussing. I'm going to forgo that in the case of Bleak House because I do think the plot is probably known to anyone who might be listening to this podcast. And it really is a long, digressive, winding sort of plot. You know, it's one of those plots which is best either condensed to one or two sentences or listed out in a couple of pages, and synopses are readily available online. Instead, I want to talk about what made me choose this particular book and the context in which at least I was reading it, although I suppose the two co-hosts of Book Spider, Patrick Barney and Chris Malmberg, who are here as well, you know, they just kind of read it to read it, and now I'm going to impose that context on them. I'm Hans Berger, the other of the three hosts of Book Spider. So I've had a little bit of a history with this book as kind of like a moral failure, right? Because the three of us all attended the same MFA program, and during that program, we all took a class on forms of fiction with a British-American instructor. And I don't remember what gave rise to it, but at one point that instructor made a reference to Bleak House and then realized, based on the reaction in the room, that no one in that class had read Bleak House. And I've always remembered how surprised and saddened she seemed by that discovery. And this was not somebody that I worked with much or had much of a deep connection to. And I don't really even remember much about anything that she actually taught me about fiction. And I don't have a great sense of what her tastes were. I just have this very particular memory of her becoming suddenly crestfallen on realizing that no one in this room full of American MFA students had read Bleak House or knew enough about it to have it work as an example in a craft discussion. And I actually bought a copy of Bleak House a couple of years later while I was living in South Korea, somewhat spurred by that moment. You know, I was in an English language bookstore in Korea, and the pickings were not great, to be frank. It was a whole lot of Murakami and a few classics. And I bought a copy of Bleak House, spurred by that recollection. And, you know, that period was a low ebb for my own motivation and acuity as a reader. I bounced off it a couple of times and then went back and got some Murakami instead and left Bleak House behind when I returned to the States. And all of this came back into my mind recently when I read the discussion that occurred around a study which found that it sampled a group of American English majors at a university in the Midwest and found that about half of those sampled English majors were unable to independently read the first two paragraphs of Bleak House. Meaning, you know, they would meet one-on-one with these English majors, they would say, here's two paragraphs, read them, tell me what's happening, what it means, right? And, you know, they gave these kids the opportunity to use dictionaries, whatever kind of secondary research they needed to wade through the paragraph. And half of them were just unable, right? And that was a bit of a, you know, there was a bit of a conversation around that study, what it meant about not just literacy, but about literacy even among people who had kind of chosen literature as an area of study. The author James Marriott cited that in his influential essay, The Dawn of the Post-Literate Society, which essentially argues that the attentional degradation caused by the smartphone is destroying written culture, and the attendant methods of thought and analysis connected to written culture, and that that may have very unpleasant social consequences. And it was interesting to me to see that same novel once again arise in the context of something kind of tragically lost. And it made me want to have a run at the thing myself and see if it could bear all that weight. So, I read this, and I think I'm less interested maybe in talking about the theme, just the theme of this book in a vacuum, right? What is it trying to say about class in Victorian England? And more so about how it sits in and represents the whole kind of history of fiction and literature and the written word in the Anglophone world that, you know, the three of us all participate in to one extent or another. And I don't know if this is, maybe this is an odd starting place because I didn't tell you guys ahead of time that we were going to be taking this lens, but while reading this novel, I was also rereading George Orwell's Coming Up for Air, which is a lovely book that I adore, and it's something we have covered on a previous episode. And Coming Up for Air is interesting, I think, because it sits chronologically almost exactly halfway between our time and Dickens's. But, you know, the Orwell, I think, feels timeless to me in a way, right? If I read it without context and somebody told me, oh, this is a period piece, right? It's set in the early 40s, but it was written in the 1970s or it was written in the 90s. I would find that plausible, right? Whereas Bleak House, I think, feels very tied to its time, both culturally but also aesthetically. So do you guys agree with that assessment that there's a timeless quality to Coming Up for Air and a datedness to Bleak House? Or am I off base on that? And if you do agree, what do you think is creating that effect?
I agree, and I think that the reason why Bleak House feels dated, there are a couple different reasons. I think that the pouring out of emotions that characters express in such bombastic and, in such bombastic ways is characteristic of a time that is quite gone by, you know? So I guess this novel may be set in 1827, 1830, though it was written later, 1853 or something like that.
I think 1853.
1852, 1853, yeah. So there's that kind of speech that just that characters have that just, you know, isn't around anymore. So that feels a little out of date. I think that the also like the idea of an estate, this is a spoiler for the end, the idea of an estate being kind of used up within the judicial, the legislative or rather judicial process of trying to figure out who gets what is a little out of date. Like, you really don't have such a slow moving judicial process anymore. I mean, sure, things can take a while, but, you know, not decades and decades, it doesn't seem. So there's a couple reasons why it feels out of date. Maybe there are probably more.
Chris, did you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm thinking like Orwell's kind of an interesting comparison, because I think Orwell is writing in a sort of tradition that is not a tradition, but a style that is more timeless. So like, and I'm trying to think if there was stylists that were so transparent and journalistic in their storytelling in Dickens's era. It's not really my specialty. I'm thinking like Chekhov and others that are similarly like, I guess, unadorned and, you know, how many different ways can you say transparent and journalistic? But that, I think, has a kind of timeless quality to it. And then Dickens is, I mean, it's sort of, they're almost emblematic of two sides of a kind of arbitrary spectrum. Dickens is synonymous with this storytelling at this time, right? This is people, when you are affecting a style and trying to make it sound like it is from like the mid 19th century, you write, you know, a little bit like Dickens. And so I think that there's, there's maybe a kind of a storytelling style that didn't really exist at this time, at least not to my knowledge, that is, like I said, more journalistic, more transparent, less melodramatic, like Patrick was saying. You know, and then Dickens is a signpost for this time. Like I don't know if I would be able to recognize Dickens at a line level if you just sort of like handed a page to me, but I would still zero in on, you know, when it was written, because of how he has become representative of that time.
It's interesting to me that it's like there's a set of ideas about well-written fiction that just didn't quite exist in the 1850s that kind of you see reflected in the Orwell, and that I think to some extent have maybe frozen in amber a little bit, right? And maybe because they kind of are just the best way of doing things. But, you know, you mentioned Chekhov, right? And I've been reading A Swim in the Pond in the Rain by George Saunders, which is a collection of short fiction, Russian short fiction, with essays about what makes those works function. And there's a couple of Chekhov stories in that. And reading the Chekhov also around the time that I was reading Dickens, I was struck by how much more... You know, the Chekhov stories are maybe the most, to me in reading them at least, in comparison with Dickens, the kind of signal characteristic is room for interpretation, right? That you hint at an unknown interior space within the characters without, and you might write something that's in some way, you know, Chekhov stories might be very internal to the character, but there's still some way in which we are left to kind of formulate our own sense of what a moment means or what an action means or why someone is doing something or how things should be taken. And I think that habit, you know, it does have some function of transparency. In some ways you can call it transparent and journalistic because it is, simpler in some ways, right? It's somehow both simpler and more complicated, right? Like it uses a simpler kind of narration to achieve a more sophisticated and complex artistic effect. And, you know, we all, again, we're in an MFA program and we all read Chekhov, right? There's like something that Chekhov created that became, to a fair extent, how we think about and evaluate good fiction. And it hasn't, I don't know that those standards have really changed so much in the scheme of things, right? It's like the development of the form stopped somewhere around the 70s, and to some extent for longer than our whole lives, the goal has essentially been Chekhov. And that's a drastic oversimplification, right? But I do think that it, obviously Chekhov and Orwell are very different writers, but they share perhaps a... Well, I don't know. I was going to say they share a little bit of that enigmatic quality, but that's not true at all, actually. I suppose in some ways, you know, Orwell is a writer who is much more, Well, I don't know. He doesn't go over the top explaining the meanings of things and the valence of things in the way that Dickens does. But I don't know if anybody could, right? There's a moment I remember when Lord Dedlock is near the end of the novel. Spoilers for Bleak House, I guess. Near the end of the novel, Count Dedlock, Lord Dedlock is. Saying Count Dedlock, what a moron, is saying is saying that he is not mad, he's not going to renounce his wife for having a child out of wedlock before they met, and he says that in a very eloquent way that I found very moving, you know, and my level of engagement with this novel kind of drifted in and out, honestly. It's very long, stuffed.
100%.
By contemporary standards, it could certainly use an editor, right? It feels just like it was written before the contemporary idea of how one even edits fiction, right? And maybe there were things written in the 1850s that reflected those standards, but I don't think so, you know? There were certain character moments that, in spite of all that, I found deeply moving. And, you know, when Dedlock says that he is not renouncing his wife for her disgrace, that you know, all that he has is still hers, I found that very moving. And then the next paragraph, his formal array of words might have, at any other time, as it has often had, something ludicrous in it, but at this time it is serious and affecting. And it's like, fuck you, Dickens.
Yeah.
You ruined it. You didn't need to say that, right?
Right.
And it's like the signature innovation of Chekhov, in a way, was like, or maybe not Chekhov particularly, but of the transition to the 20th century, was understanding that we can work that out for ourselves, you know? And I don't know if, I mean, it seems like a simple thing when you put it that way, but it like that kind of the inability to trust the reader is just adding so much bulk to this novel and so much to wade through.
I like that a lot, because one of the other questions that you sent was connecting Dickens to Pynchon, and I really like that. I mean, there's a couple of obvious things, like the names are playful. There's a kind of digressive brilliance to it that is sort of coiled around mystery, and that sort of always coiled around mystery. And it seems like a Dickens and a Pynchon thing. But there isn't, it's weird, because like you don't really think of Pynchon as an economy writer, but you're talking about economy when it comes to wrapping things up and explaining things. And I was, you know, racking my brain, like, what is, you know, what is the distinction between Dickens and Pynchon, other than like the time in which they were writing? And you know, there's a number of them, I think that there's something on that thread that you just sort of pulled to do with Dickens not leaving the interiority of the characters unexplained. Everything does need to wrap up or be, you know, come to light. And if you remove that that obligation to the reader, maybe you get something more like Pynchon. I don't know. But that, I really do like that avenue.
Another similarity between Pynchon and Bleak House, I'll say Bleak House and Against the Day, and to a lesser extent, the one we just read, which was called Inherent Vice, was a penchant for, it seems like both are interested in creating are doing some amount of world building, like constructing the vibe of the time and place in which the story is set. So that's in a different direction. It doesn't, you know, it's just an additional similarity that I thought was interesting.
Well, yeah, Pynchon would never write the first two paragraphs of of Bleak House the way that Dickens is written.
Sure, that's
true. He's just not as interested in setting.
Before we move on, like, why? I wonder why you asked that question about the first two paragraphs, Hans. Like, your question is, you know, could people have puzzled their way through this after the smartphone era? It seems like pretty clear, like an establishing shot in a film, right?
Yeah, it really doesn't seem that hard. It seems like a strange segment of a novel to pull out and then, like, you know, use that way.
So let me try to point to, as I understand it, to what's difficult about that, right? And I'll just go ahead and read the first paragraph at least, right? Maybe not both, but the first. And then I'll talk a bit about my understanding of what it is that is what it is that was tripping up the people in the survey, and why I am interested in your thoughts about whether or not our peers could have deciphered it, right? London, Michaelmas term lately over, and the Lord Chancellor sitting in Lincoln's Inn Hall. Implacable November weather. As much mud in the streets as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth, and it would not be so wonderful to meet a megalosaurus, 40 feet long or so, waddling like an elephantine lizard up Horbone Hill. Smoke lowering down from chimney pots, making a soft black drizzle with flakes of soot in it as big as full-grown snowflakes. Gone into mourning, one might imagine, for the death of the sun. Dogs indistinguishable in mire. Horses, scarcely better, splashed to their very blinkers. Foot passengers jostling one another's umbrellas in a general infection of ill temper and losing their foothold at street corners where tens of thousands of other foot passengers have been slipping and sliding since the day broke, if the day ever broke. Adding new deposits to the crust upon crust of mud, sticking at those points tenaciously to the pavement and accumulating at compound interest. I should say, I do love that, right?
Yeah,
it's awesome. A good paragraph.
What's up with the megalosaurus? Explain to me what is meant by the indication of a megalosaurus.
Size of the streets in London, size of, you know.
Wrong.
Wrong?
Nope. I believe that's wrong.
Okay.
Chris, any thoughts?
It's basically talking about how wet it is, and it's the floods have just sort of basically a prehistoric era has just passed because it's so wet and the floods have just receded, and that's what it seems like it says. But
my understanding of it as much mud in the streets as if the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth, and it would not be wonderful to meet a megalosaurus. So the waters had but newly retired from the face of the earth. I think that language comes pretty directly from the King James Bible discussing after Noah's flood, right? So the idea is that there's so much mud that it is as though Noah's flood has just receded, and this was very recently the bottom of the ocean, and we're seeing a megalosaurus because it is the immediate aftermath of Noah's flood. Now, does that totally make sense in terms of standard readings of the Bible? Maybe not, right? I mean, it's 1853. People don't know archaeology, paleontology. But that's my understanding of the invocation of the megalosaurus.
So did we fail? Did we fail like the...
Chris, I think you got it close enough.
You didn't fail. I'm a big failure. I don't think I'm wrong. I didn't get the specific idea you had.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, my recollection of reading the study is that that is Patrick, your answer would have been counted wrong. Chris, your answer would have been counted correct. Now, is there within the text room for interpretation to support both? Yeah, maybe, sure, but, you know, it. I think part of the reason they were chosen is they are very familiar, being, you know, positioned at the beginning of a great work, and so there is kind of a general sense of what they mean that would align pretty much with Chris's.
But it's not really an important fucking, like, thing. Like, it's a weird, you know, it's like Patrick mentioned an establishing shot. It's like the first few minutes of To Kill a Mockingbird are a kind of famous opening credits because it's showing a bunch of, you know, things that are telling you about Scout and the family and like things in their house, things in their possession. And then if you made a group of people watch the first few minutes, and then you're like, okay, what did those mean? Like, it's not really actually necessary. You know, they're there for rewatching, for digging deeper into it. But is it really fucking matter? Is that really what the question was? And the test was that, what does the Megalosaurus mean? Or what?
Well, I don't think the question was specifically, what does the Megalosaurus mean? It was more like, explain this to me. And if they didn't seem like they got the Megalosaurus, then that would be pushed on, right? I think that I have pretty mixed feelings about whether it matters, right? I mean, I think fundamentally, probably it doesn't matter to someone's ability to read the whole thing and enjoy the story and connect with the characters and feel sentimentally and be moved by the moments that, you know, most people are moved by, that I was moved by, right? I think that's totally fair. And it's there to be discovered, right? In the sense that you can read it and connect with it. In some ways, actually, you know, I was thinking about this when we were talking about Pynchon, and it's another way that, I don't know why I keep trying to connect this to Pynchon, but that feels significant. And there's other Pynchon stuff I want to dig back into. But, like, Dickens, this novel in particular, has this interesting quality of being both somehow over-explained and strikingly dense, you know? It has this way of being, at moments, over-explained in just the way of the passage that I read earlier that, you know, we were kind of laughing at. And in some places, you know, there are a lot of little kind of pretty densely constructed little verbal games, like the whole scene setting with the Megalosaurus and the fog and all that, right? Which maybe is actually, I think, something that has made it stand the test of time. You know, you can read it, assuming that you have adequate time and attention, you can read it as a fifth grader and be moved by it. And you can come back to it as an adult and have a lot more fun approaching things like that. And it's tough, you know, it was tough for me because, like, I really enjoyed things like parsing that first paragraph. But at some point, you just can't, you know, at least not if you have to read it in a month for a podcast. It's interesting because it requires, and this is one thing that I struggled with, in some places it requires very little attention. In other places it requires great attention to fully extract some of what's in the language, and having to kind of like recalibrate every chapter or paragraph, I found somewhat difficult. And to some extent, I think my response to that was maybe to skim more than would have been ideal.
That and that's definitely a change in how we read now. I think that we have less time, we have far more distractions, and we are not reading it like this would have been released over I don't know how many months, right? In serialization, and you 20 months.
I believe it was serialized in 20 volumes, if I remember right.
Yeah, and you...
A little under a year. Under 2 years, rather.
Yeah, you're sipping that whiskey real slow, and you're really savoring it. So, like, you know, that's a very different way of reading it.
The other thing that reminded me of Pynchon in this, and this connects again to how this feels aesthetically dated, or dated as a question of technique, is the clash of tones here is very interesting, right? Where you have some sections that are very silly, like sections, characters, moments that are just kind of froth in a way. And then you have some that are incredibly didactic, right? You have things like the, I can't remember her name, but like there's a character where, as far as I can tell, and maybe I missed a greater plot or structure significance here, but like there's a character whose whole thing is just that her first two husbands have died and she and her third husband both think that the first two were more impressive, right? And the joke is just this person exists and this is how she is. And, you know, she kind of comes in and does her shtick and exits, right? And then you have like these other sections that are incredibly, you know, like when he's discussing, there are a couple places where he'll pretty much just kind of switch from narrator into, I guess, what you could actually call a journalistic view and just say, like, look at this slum. This is awful. This is disgusting. This is no place fit for human habitation. There's this interesting kind of clash of tones where you have this very, very light, silly, very unrealistic comic material combined with moments, intermittent moments of the highest kind of moral certitude and seriousness. And that, I think, the way that those sit next to each other, I think, is aesthetically, I mean, I guess it works, right, by definition, because many, many people have read and enjoyed this. But it's, again, something that I think, by contemporary standards, would be a strange aesthetic choice and is something that that Pynchon is, in somewhat more exaggerated ways, it's very characteristic also of Pynchon, right? Like, complete cartoon horseshit nonsense combined with these occasional moments of just straight didactic, very, very serious lecturing. And it's something that, by modern standards, is just kind of not a way you're supposed to arrange fiction. Back to the idea of like how changes in attention or changes in literacy affect something like this, right? Do you... And this question sounds a little bit snotty the way that I wrote it, but I'm genuinely curious. In a lot of the writing around the kind of panic of the post-literate age and the degradation of attention and literacy around technology, there's an idea I kept encountering that, like, this is something that has been Bleak House, Dickens, this is something that has been, at least in Britain, maybe less so in America, has been kind of passed down generationally for 150 years, right? And that we're reaching a point where that can't be passed down generationally anymore, and there's a kind of a loss of cultural memory there. Does that resonate with either of you as people who have kids? Do you feel like this is emblematic of something you could still give to your own children as an inheritance?
Patrick, do you want to go first? You have more kids, man. You have more kids. You get to go first.
Should I give this to my children? You know, I don't feel like this would be a book that I would hand to them and be like, you have to read this. But I would definitely hope that it is still available for them to read if they want. It does seem to me that having a connection to a shared cultural past is good, just in general. So, like, being able to understand some of the terms that, you know, Dickens uses in the first two or seven chapters. I was actually, first two or seven chapters of the book, I was actually looking up that study you were talking about, Hans. It does seem like it would be better, like, overall, if my children, or at least some children in the world, should be able to engage with this text, you know, if they so desire. Like, that seems like a good thing. I don't know that I would, this would not be, as I said, a book that I would be like, this is what I want you to read. I would be more inclined to push something like Coming Up for Air, which you've mentioned, Hans, on them rather than this. But, you know.
I guess, like, I've pushed enough books on younger people and then had my heart broken by them not enjoying it, that, like, it's not really, I don't know that I, you know, I'm still reading children's books with Cam, and you know, when he gets older, I guess I'll, you know, throw some Animorphs at him, and then, you know, some, I mean, it's such a strange, so, like, I don't think of it as heritage that, like, I have any connection to, and so I don't really feel in position to, you know, have Cam read it. I would love to, you know, read The Night Before Christmas, with him, and I'm trying to think of other stuff from the 1800s, but I guess, like, Moby Dick. I'm going to be an asshole about Moby Dick. Read Moby Dick. And Moby Dick is Moby Dick is, like, way harder than this novel. But it's also more interesting to me. So I don't know. It's just it's a hard question to get an angle on.
I found it to be less hard just because I was more interested in Moby Dick, like, on a consistent basis. Like, I don't think that Bleak House really held my attention very well until maybe two thirds of the way in, when, like, plot lines started to coalesce. But I still felt like I, you know, caught all the major plot elements. Even though I wasn't, you know, quite as interested as I was when reading, you know, Moby Dick.
I will admit that I was reading the Wikipedia synopsis along with.
Yeah, so was I.
Partly because of some of the in and out of attention that I described, from, like, some sections being much, much more dense than others. And I would read, like, literally 150 pages and then look at the Wikipedia synopsis and realize I advanced, like, two sentences in the synopsis.
Right.
But I did feel like this odd undertone of guilt reading this in the context of having established it as this sort of, like, lost paradise of literacy, because I didn't like it that much, mostly. And I do feel like it's kind of, by contemporary standards, a somewhat bad book.
Yeah, I don't think it's great.
Maybe it's better received if there is some way in which it is speaking to you. I don't find that it is speaking to me at all. Like, I don't have, and maybe this is another angle in your question, Hans. The reason that I would have Cam read Moby Dick is that I feel like the themes of Moby Dick are, even if Moby Dick doesn't read like it could be from any time, the themes in Moby Dick are expansive, and they explode beyond the era in which it was written. And it isn't about, you know, in this case, the Court of Chancery, you know, and, you know, like, this is really zeroing in on a topic and a subject, and written in a style that I just don't have any connection to. And so, yeah, just, I'm trying to think of Dickens books that have a kind of a resonance with our lives today. And I guess maybe that is circling back to your question. I don't know that Bleak House is relevant to life today.
Why does Coming Up for Air feel like it has resonance to our lives and Bleak House doesn't? Is it because of the sense of impending doom? Is it just because there's a psychological realness to the characters that is kind of timeless in a way that the sort of manneredness of these characters does not feel timeless?
I think it's both. I think that Tubby bowling and coming up for air is psychologically real and interesting in a way that there really aren't any. I mean, this is maybe you guys disagree, but I don't think Bleak House has a non-flat character. Every character is kind of surface value, it seems like, except for maybe Lady Deadlock, who is somewhat surprising as things progress. But that seems like something going for coming up for air that Bleak House doesn't have. And yeah, it definitely, you know, the sense of World War II coming on in coming up for air feels definitely closer to our reality now. So I think both of those things are reasons why coming up for air is at least more interesting to a modern reader than Bleak House, or to us as modern readers than Bleak House is. Even if we're not quite sure yet if Coming Up for Air truly is a timeless novel. I mean, you know, because, you know, we don't quite know if it's going to last like the way, say, Shakespeare has lasted, or the Homeric epics, or some of Virgil's stuff.
Probably safe to assume at this point that 1984 will last in the ways that those do.
Right.
But, I mean, whether or not anything else of Orwell's has the same endurance is harder to say.
Right.
It's interesting, though, how some things that feel very tied to a particular time and place endure and others don't. Because, like, Coming Up for Air is an incredibly granular and particular and vivid description of two cultures, right? Of, like, you know, bourgeois culture in London in the late 30s and of his life at the end of the 19th century. I mean, there are sections of Coming Up for Air where his childhood is probably not too different from something a Dickens character would experience.
Right, yeah.
But the kind of the honesty with which it is portrayed in Coming Up for Air, I think, makes it endure in a way that the manneredness of Bleak House does not.
I'm still puzzling my way through this question about literacy that you asked. I'm for some reason I'm like hooked on it. And I wonder how much of the Coming Up for Air, there's not nearly as much use of terms that just don't have much, or I won't say no analog, but just are the terms are super different. Like, so Michaelmas is a end of summer or beginning of fall Christian festival that's on you know a liturgical calendars. We don't celebrate it in the US, but they still do in the UK. Now that is a term that does show up in Austin, in Thomas Hardy, and other places, other British fiction, but and probably in Orwell too, but there still seems like there are way more terms in Bleak House that we really don't have much cultural connection to, whereas Coming Up for Air seems to have more shared vocabulary. Does this make sense, what I'm saying? I feel like I'm over-explaining.
Yeah, it does make sense. I wonder if part of it is just the, for whatever reason, and I don't know if this is a deliberate craft choice or just an accident of history, but a lot of what is uncertain in Orwell terminology wise is very easily discernible from context, right? Like there's a bunch of stuff about fishing that refers to a lot of different types of insects you can use as bait. And I don't know what any of those insect types are, but I can tell from context good enough to be able to move with the flow of the writing, you know? And I would imagine, I mean, Orwell must have been somewhat aware that he would have, for instance, an American audience that did not use the same type of larvae to bait a hook.
Yeah, he probably would have.
But that he, I'd think that he would have, or a, I don't know, a French audience or whatever, right? And, but, so he, going back to the ways in which, like, our ideas of good fiction were just kind of, like, settled even in Orwell's time, it's almost like the advancement of a technology, right? Like the technology of the novel had advanced to the point that it was, I don't know, like the refrigerator hasn't changed all that much since a certain period in history, right? There've been like minor changes, but for the most part, like refrigerators basically have worked the same since the 40s. And it's like the novel is kind of the same. Like there's a set of ideas for how to do a novel around things like making specific jargon contextually interpretable that Orwell had that Dickens didn't. And there just hasn't been, there haven't been new ideas necessarily since then.
Yeah. Like, yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Like Dickens doesn't do anything to make plain what the Lord Chancery is, right? Whereas in Orwell, you probably he would have done something if he had used that term to make it clear what he was trying to say.
Why has Dickens endured? Why has Dickens lived on? Because it seems to me like this is, in many ways, a work which is dated in ways that should have tied it to its time,
right,
both culturally and aesthetically. And it shouldn't be, you know, like my mom read me Dickens when I was a kid, right? It would never have occurred to me, never have occurred to her to read me Thomas Hardy. And even Thomas Hardy, I think, is...
He's dated, but I think he's better.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like The Mayor of Casterbridge, I found to be much more compelling than this, and still kind of dated and weird. And there are lots of craft critiques you could make of The Mayor of Casterbridge,
right,
but it is ultimately a much, much more compelling work.
Right. 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 Right.
So why has Dickens endured?
Maybe for the same reason that, and this is just me guessing, the same reason that people still like, I'm going to use this word genre, even though I don't actually believe that genre and literary can be divided anymore. Like my views on that have changed. I think that genre is just a way of talking about certain popular works with, where the writer is more interested in doing certain formulas than they are in writing aesthetically. So that's all I'm going to say. But I think that popular work of this kind is still the highest selling stuff as far as fiction is concerned, right? Like you know, big fantasies, big mafia stories, you know, like formulaic ideas that, or detective stories or what have you. Formulaic ideas are still big sellers in the fiction world. And it seems to me that this kind of novel would be interesting to someone who is also interested in modern big selling formulaic stuff.
So in some ways, is it, thinking about other things we've read for the podcast, is this kind of an unholy union between like Pynchon and that Dean Koontz novel?
Yeah, it probably is.
I mean, I guess it's somehow the predecessor to both of those things in equal measure.
Yeah, it probably is like an unholy union of the book that is trying to excite you and titillate you and, you know, do all of that, while also combining this like wide vibey view of a place and time.
Yeah, I think it's the place and time, you know, as much as anything. I think that maybe one, do we need a touchstone sort of author for every sort of era to kind of like sort of like chapter headings for those eras? Because it feels like Dickens is the frame, was one of the major sort of components to the frame through which we see like the mid 19th century, you know, and in England, in Europe, England and London particularly. So it's like mid 19th century London. If you're going to do a kind of a treatment of that time and that place, you have to reconcile with Dickens. And I don't know if, like, in the canon, would you say that Dickens is considered a, you know, sort of touchstone literary figure, or is the line really blurred between, you know, literature and popularity at this time, where like they don't really distinguish from one another, especially with novels? I don't really know this period very well. Do either of you know like an answer to that?
I could be wrong. I'm not an expert in this period. I think that Dickens is notable as a touchstone for fiction as a virtuous thing in the world, right?
Yeah,
He was the first humanist fiction author, right? Like, the whole point of Bleak House is rich man forgives his wife for a youthful indiscretion, where the normal expectation would be to socially and economically sanction her, right? It's fundamentally a novel of forgiveness transcending social expectations of punishment, lent a certain amount of you know, emotional piquancy by the forgiven person dying before she has the ability to understand that her sins are not really sins, right? And that's good. I mean, that's a good thing to have in the world. And I think it is, I think, kind of the moral force of that was one of the few things that I found moving and enduring here, right? The beneficence of that did, even though I kind of spotlighted it as a place where the craft kind of, you know, pulled the rug out, it still, it means something, right? And to the question of why this would be enduringly interesting or moving to a contemporary reader, that's probably a portion of it.
Sure.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. It is, you know, I wouldn't say that he's not really writing very diverse novels, but that's not really incumbent on him in his time and place. But there is a diversity in his graciousness to characters from different classes and hardships and he does write from a humanist perspective and make that very entertaining and make it
I don't know about very entertaining.
Well, I mean,
somewhat
very entertaining if it's 1853 and you don't have any other choices.
I would say more entertaining if, you know, you just trimmed down. It seems like so much of this could be just trimmed away and you'd have a leaner, more interesting, you know, well, maybe not more interesting, but a leaner, more engaging novel.
And even something like Great Expectations, which I have read a couple times, It's been a long time since I read Great Expectations, but I do remember feeling like it was much more effective than this, you know? And from background reading, it seems like this is regarded as one of the best Dickens novels, but like Great Expectations, at least, did not feel bloated in the way that this does. And there's an effect I remember when I read Great Expectations, and I don't know if I would see the same thing now, but I remember being really struck by how over and over and over again, Pip will meet a character who on first glance appears to be terrifying or evil or just reduced to this very simple idea. And then as he gets to know them, they actually reveal greater layers of humanity and depth and compassion. And, you know, like Megwitch seems at the beginning like this kind of demon, essentially. And then as we get to know Megwitch, he's actually somebody with a much richer soul than you would think, right? And that cycle of you encounter a character, you have a very simple instinctive response to the character, and then you see more humanity in the character and more emotional layering happens, as I remember it, like 8 times in a row, and is kind of interesting every time. And I think that's very indicative of the best of Dickens as a kind of moral idea. I say as a guy who barely knows Dickens. Okay. Well, I think that pretty much touches on everything that I was interested in discussing. I will have to admit here, I went into the reading of this thinking that I would come out of the experience feeling enormous sentimental fondness for Dickens and a great sadness at the idea that it might kind of pass from the world. And coming out the other end, like, even though I still... Obviously, it makes me very sad to think that, like, people might stop reading and engaging with big, ambitious, complicated fiction generally, and I think I've expressed that particular sentimentalism a number of times on the pod. Bleak House in particular kind of does seem like a museum piece to me, actually, and I don't... It seems odd that it has... that people have even continued to have the kind of flesh-and-blood relationship with it, even up till this point. And if I were, you know, our professor, I would not have been surprised that a room full of American English majors in 2010 had not read this book.
Yeah, I agree. And I have generally a hard time, like, accepting that things should just be allowed to go... things should just be allowed to crumble or be forgotten. Like I am sort of err on the side of trying to preserve people's connection to their past through the artifacts of that past. And yet I think that is, there's layers to that. And like, you know, just because something is no longer in rotation doesn't mean it can't be revisited, as you say, in a museum. I think that it is, you know, it's one thing for people to no longer like read long, ambitious, complicated novels. And I hope people do continue to do that, but I don't think that they need to. Bleak House doesn't need to be one of them. Yeah.
One problem is it's not actually that complicated.
It's not complicated. That's the thing.
It's long.
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, no, that's exactly it.
But it's not complex like Against the Day is.
It's not challenging. It's not complex. It's not challenging.
Or even something long like Flicker or The Sotweed Factor, which are long, more straightforward than Against the Day, but still... more thematically rich than this one is, I would think.
Yeah, I agree. All right, well, Patrick, what are we reading next?
Oh man, I've been torturing myself over what to pick next because I have a more special episode that I'm kind of thinking of, a more special like theoretical topic that I've been thinking about. And I was thinking about going with that, but I think this time around, I'm still going to let that more special topic kind of germinate or percolate or ferment, whatever metaphoric word you like, and just go with the more traditional pick of a novel this time. And I think we're going to go with The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin.
Fuck yeah.
Which is a good book. You know, yeah, it's a good book. It's kind of funky. It's definitely sci-fi, but you know, it speaks to some of the gender issues and whatnot that are going on right now. So it's definitely worthwhile.
Well, that's a funny coincidence. I was just watching the last episode of the show Pluribus last night, or the last episode of the first season of the show Pluribus, and she's reading Left Hand of Darkness in one scene.
Interesting.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Well, this has been our discussion of Bleak House by Charles Dickens, a classic that has somehow endured in spite of being not nearly as good as even most Victorian fiction. If you disagree heartily with that statement, please send an email to bookspider1001@gmail.com. And next week we'll be talking about Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin, which I'm sure we will all be much kinder to. Thanks everybody for listening. Thank you, gentlemen, for your thoughts, and hope everybody has a good 2 weeks.